Can Sean McVay save Jared Goff? Plus some curious hires for the Chargers and Bills. We deep dive the coaching carousel. Plus big mailbag, including whether the Falcons can pressure Tom Brady and more Super Bowl stuff. End the QB searches in San Francisco and Cleveland. All that in a jam-packed MMQB 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the 10 Things NFL Look Ahead podcast. I am Gary Gramling here with Andy Benoit. And if you missed the Monday show, and if you did, how dare you? And we are very disappointed in you. But Andy is down in Mobile, Alabama for the Senior Bowl right now. So when you hear Andy's voice momentarily, don't be alarmed. He is not underwater. He is not in space. He is somewhere safe, just talking on a phone instead of a microphone. Andy, how's it going down there?
It's going well, and bear with us. We will have regular microphone status back on Monday, so where I'm not going to sound all like the NASA radio kind of crackly coming back through to Houston. I'm not going to sound like that for much longer, but a little bit today here.
I think you sound great, Andy, and I think it's going to sound even better when we start talking some coaches and coaching carousel and coaching changes. Also, some of the coordinators who were landing with teams this offseason. We've been talking about this show for a couple weeks, and we're going to do it. We're finally going to do it. We will talk a little bit of Super Bowl when we get to the mailbag, but right now we are talking coaches, and we're going to start in Los Angeles where Sean McVay got the Rams job. And Andy, we talked about this a couple shows ago. I personally am terrified on behalf of Jared Goff. I think he was overwhelmed as a rookie, and I think a lot of that had to do with basically one of the worst offensive lines in football, really one of the worst supporting casts in football, basically working with him. So I don't know. Tell me something good about Jared Goff right now.
I think he has a pro style skill set. He looks the part. He can play within the pocket. He throws the ball well enough. The release is good. The accuracy was not good enough as a rookie, but I think it can be. I was uncomfortable for much of his rookie season. Keep in mind, he stepped into a losing team that had a very bad offensive line and therefore had no running game and was severely limited at wide receiver. Most rookies will struggle in that kind of condition. A lot of it's going to remain the same. They're not going to overhaul this thing in one season in Los Angeles. So he will have to fight through this some more. But I think the foundation's fine. We can't, you don't want to judge those first few games too much. You want to judge his approach to the game. And something we talked about 2 weeks ago that I think is a sign for optimism is how he, at least as the season got later in the season, he at least was willing to play with bodies around him in the pocket. He stopped looking at the pass rush so much and started keeping his eyes downfield a little more. Now, he has a long way to go in that department, and it's vital that he get there because you can't play in the NFL if you're looking at the pass rush. But early on when he was in his first few games, that was a problem. He was looking at the pass rush. He was under siege. It's natural. The fact that he got hit as much as he did and still improved at not looking at the pass rush, I think that's a real positive sign, a real encouraging sign anyway.
Okay. All right. And also, I mean, reason for encouragement is Sean McVay comes on. And you actually had written a piece about Sean McVay last spring, touting him as a future head coach and a guy who's a candidate to become the youngest head coach in NFL history, which he did this offseason. McVay had a lot more talent to work with in Washington. He takes over Rob Boris here he takes over as head coach. Rob Boris was the offensive coordinator, but his system takes over in LA here. Can it work early on with the limitations he's going to have with his offense?
Well, it's not going to work the way it did for Washington. They had such a better offensive line in Washington. They had speed at the wide receiver position, which they really don't have in Los Angeles. I know Tavon Austin's fast, but he's not a perimeter speedy receiver. He's fast and quick as a gadget guy, totally different than DeSean Jackson. So, no, it's not going to work as well because he doesn't have the same resources. But that doesn't mean that he's going to, you know, he can run other stuff too. And I would imagine he has a flexible mind. We haven't seen it because he hasn't been around as an offensive coordinator very long. So we only know his profile from Washington. Mm-hmm. But I would imagine we'll see a different version of Sean McVay these first few years, and one that will make good use of the running game. He'll probably do a lot of overloaded tight end sets in the running game, meaning he'll put two tight ends on the field and line them up side by side up on the line of scrimmage and create a longer offensive line surface to one side. He'll do stuff like that. But he'll have to, it's going to be a feeling out process for him, certainly, because this is not a position, obviously head coach is a position he's not been in before, but having the kind of personnel limitations, that's not a position he's been in either before.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a plus here is McVay brings with him Wade Phillips, who was out the door with Gary Kubiak in Denver. Kubiak retired. Phillips was not retained when they hired Vance Joseph. But, you know, Phillips taking over this defense, it's certainly a talented defense, not to the extent that Phillips had in Denver. Do you like this fit with Wade Phillips taking over this defensive roster?
I love it because you also have a former head coach that's doing it, and McVay is not experienced on the defensive side of the ball, and I think it was a brilliant move to get Phillips. Keep in mind, when these guys interview for jobs, and when in this case there were reports that Phillips there were reports that Phillips would be joining McVay before he got the job. It was that was the rumor, and that came true. Almost always, when a coach interviews for a head coaching job, he has his coordinators in mind, and they pretend like they don't because it's politics and you want to look like you're giving everybody an opportunity. But so often, when that's a big question they get asked in the interview, is who's going to be your coordinator?
Yeah.
And if you're a 30-year-old guy who's an offensive coach, they're going to want to know who your defensive coordinator is. And to answer back, my coordinator is Wade Phillips, I'm sure that helps seal the deal for McVay. That took the edge off of his age thing. And anybody can see that. But it takes Phillips, and he's an older coach, obviously, but take all that aside, just Phillips the schemer, that's a good fit too for Los Angeles, because that's a guy who understands how to take advantage of a dynamic pass rush. He does a lot with his blitz packages. The Rams have incredible speed, not just along the defensive line with Robert Quinn and, of course, Aaron Donald. They're also very fast at linebacker, and I would imagine we're going to see them really use that. They have Mark Barron and Alec Ogletree. There might not be a faster linebacking duo in football, so there's a lot of versatility there to use. And if you're versatile at linebacker, which is something Phillips did not really have in Denver, by the way, not this kind of versatility. If you're versatile, then you can do a lot more with your disguises as well, because they can drop these guys into coverage. Be a very multiple defense. So I like what they're doing here, and to have a playmaking defense, that's great, because they're going to have to rely on that defense to win some games for them. They're going to have to score points or create big time field position advantages through that defense. And Phillips has a scheme to do that.
Yep. Yeah. If you were wondering, the day Sean McVay just turned 31 this week. The day he was born, Wade Phillips had just finished his stint as the New Orleans Saints interim head coach, and was about to be hired as the Eagles defensive coordinator under Buddy Ryan. So there you go.
Very good.
And there's McVay a big age difference.
McVay worked with Wes Phillips in Washington, too. So it's not like he and Wade Phillips, there's some history there. There's a background there, and I'm sure Wade Phillips would not have taken the job if Wes did not vouch for Sean McVay to his dad.
Yep, yep. Well, let's stay in L.A. here. We talked about Anthony Lynn a little bit on the Monday show, but let's dive ever so slightly deeper. Anthony Lynn, the Bills offensive coordinator and interim head coach, all that happened this season. Before that, he was just their position coach at running back. He gets the Chargers job. He was a guy who had been basically billed as a head coach in the making over the last year or two, but the exciting thing here is he retains Ken Whisenhunt for an offense that really wasn't a problem. They had some sort of micro problems as far as getting some of their young receivers on the same page with Phillip Rivers, but there won't be any wholesale changes here on this offense.
There doesn't need to be. It was a very well put together offense. They did a great job with route combinations. No team in football last season was better and more diverse with crossing patterns. They're great in that regard. The offense is in good shape, and it's great that they're letting Wisenhunt continue to run it. I'm sure Lynn will have some say in what goes on with the ground game, and he'll probably work with Melvin Gordon. I think the other side of the ball to me, though, is the interesting coordinator hire here, Gary.
Yes, Gus Bradley. Gus Bradley actually apparently interviewed Anthony Lynn, I believe, for the OC job when he was down in Jacksonville a couple years ago. But they share an agent, and Gus Bradley will be the defensive coordinator there. I'll ask you this, Andy, about Gus Bradley. We've talked about we've talked plenty about Dan Quinn in the last couple weeks, obviously, as the Falcons keep on winning, and we've talked about Quinn's sort of flexibility in moving away from that cover three, that Seattle cover three that sort of made Dan Quinn, and it sort of made Gus Bradley before that. Now, Bradley's sort of on the other coin as a guy who left Seattle and didn't find that kind of success. What does he do in San Diego here? Is he a guy, is he going to try and bring that Seattle defense, or does he sort of have to rethink what his philosophy is going to be here?
Well, that to me, that's what makes it interesting. I think he needs to spread his wings and rethink it. This team is, they're not particularly fast at linebacker. So that cover three defense, that's a problem. You want speed at linebacker. You need Bobby Wagner. You need Deion Jones, those fast ground covering guys. They're very good at cornerback and diverse at corner. Casey Hayward made the Pro Bowl this year. He earned it. He was a playmaker and a stopper, traveling with number one receivers. And keep in mind, Jason Verrett, and it was only a few weeks into the season, but there was nobody who played better in weeks 1, 2, and 3 than Jason Verrett. And he was very good last year. So you'll get him back healthy. You've got bona fide number one covered corners on each side of the field, plus a veteran like Brandon Flowers. So you shouldn't be playing those guys in zone coverage. You need to be playing man-to-man with them. And you can play man-to-man out of cover three on the edges. Seattle does that a lot with Richard Sherman.
Yep.
But I'd let it be straight man-to-man across the board, and I would use Joey Bosa and Melvin Ingram, if he's there, as the movable chess pieces. This isn't a team built for cover three. They can play it, but that should not be their foundation. And what makes it interesting is, as last season wore on in Jacksonville, that defense under Gus Bradley, and even late in the year after he was fired, but before he was fired as well, they became a more diverse defense. They did expand what they were doing with their blitz packages. I had a coach today meet with me and tell me they were one of the toughest third down blitzing scheme teams they faced this season. So the Jaguars were already morphing out of cover three a little bit, or expanding beyond it. Bradley's capable of that. I'm curious to see how he does now that he has a totally different set of skill players to work with.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this Chargers defense is in a similar place to what that Jacksonville D was in. The Chargers are a little more established, but it's kind of a team where you look at it and you say, you know, this is a good collection of talent, but maybe they haven't, they haven't really added up to the sum of their parts at this point.
And part of it, they've had guys, and every team has injuries, so you got to be careful when you make this excuse. But
yeah,
they've had guys hurt at weird times. They haven't always been put together at the same time. Someone's been out, someone else has been in a different spot, someone else wasn't there. We never saw this defense fully constructed. And they had a good, what's also ironic or too bad to a certain degree, is the guy that was there before Bradley, John Pagano, he played the exact kind of scheme we're saying Bradley needs to play now. Pagano was very multiple. He did a lot of different things, including cover three. And he was a great in-game schemer. And he's now an assistant in Oakland. They lost a good defensive coordinator. I'm not criticizing Lynn for bringing in Bradley at all. I understand that you bring in your own staff. That's what they want you there for. But Bradley needs to kind of do, he needs to keep furthering the foundation that Pagano had already established, in my opinion.
All right. Well, let's go to Anthony Lynn's old team. We're going out to Buffalo. This really, these segued very nicely, the first two. I'm pretty proud of myself at this point. It'll all fall apart after this, but, the Bills hire Sean McDermott, and I mean, look, last time they hired 2 years ago, they brought in Rex Ryan, and Rex Ryan was the biggest name out there. Rex Ryan was the guy you excite your fan base with. Maybe if you were a little more cynical, you might suspect that the Bills brought in Rex Ryan in part because they were negotiating with the local government on a new stadium, and they wanted to get some support behind that. But bottom line is, Sean McDermott not nearly the sexy hire that that Rex Ryan was, and maybe that's good for this team.
He's kind of a hybrid of the two guys that ran the defense before him, Rex Ryan and Jim Schwartz. He's Jim Schwartz-like in that he plays a pretty basic 4-3 zone foundation, cover three, quarters in the red zone, or in Schwartz's case, they play a lot of cover two, just your straight up zone stuff. But he can be exotic on third downs with his blitz designs, which is what we think of when we think of Rex Ryan. McDermott is much more selective with his pressures. Rex Ryan will bring 17 of them in a game. McDermott might bring only 5 or 6. But those 5 or 6 are carefully chosen, and very often they're extremely well executed. And usually they're going to involve an edge defensive back. So Nickell Roby, for example, could have 3 or 4 sacks this season and be a prominent blitzer, which he was very good at a few years ago, by the way. I like McDermott stylistically. I like the fit for him with this defense. The one question you have is how much talent is left on that defense? Where are they on the edges? Jerry Hughes has not quite been what he was 2 years ago. Shaq Lawson's very much a mystery, and I think there are concerns about his explosiveness and his ability to bend the corner. Is he a true edge rusher? That stuff has to get sorted out, because if you're blitzing 6 or 7 times a game, then you're counting on pressure getting home on your four-man rush a lot of the other times of the game. And that's where they need to realize. And if they don't have that, they can't get that kind of pressure, then we'll see more from McDermott. And the other thing he did, Gary, this goes back a few years now, but this is part of his old foundation. He came up under Jim Johnson of Philadelphia, and that was a lot of the double-A gap and interior blitz stuff that they did in Carolina as well, but Jim Johnson was the founder of it. So we could see versions of that from McDermott.
Yeah, you know, the complaints that leaked out from Bills players over the last 2 years was it's too complex. You know, they got to play very fast under Jim Schwartz. This is, I mean, Marcell Dareus just came out and said after Ryan was dismissed, defense was too complex. You know, some people attribute that to Jerry Hughes' struggles the last 2 years. He was a double-digit sack guy under Schwartz and didn't come close to approaching that under Rex. So I don't know. I mean, how much can you sort of look at the team and say, well, you know, if they get Dareus of 2 years ago and they get Hughes of 2 years ago, maybe they could, you know, maybe they'll be all right up front.
Well, that defense of 2 years ago was one of the 5 best defenses in the NFL. So if they have that, if that works, and they very well could have that, they've also got corners, Darby, Gilmore, which at some point you got to make a decision on him, but let's say they have Gilmore. And they've got versatility at safety. They have a lot of former corners playing safety, which was a big part of Ryan's scheme. My guess is McDermott would prefer a little more size at that position. But anytime you have versatility in the secondary at that safety position, that's a good thing in today's NFL. That leaves you less vulnerable to the spread formations that teams like to do and the multi-tight end sets. You have an answer for the Travis Kelce's of the world now. So they have some good pieces here. And then I guess I saw this week, Gary, it was Zach Brown's turn to be in the Pro Bowl. Apparently they were down to him now with all the replacements. So you could say they got a Pro Bowl linebacker.
There you go. Apparently no one wants to go to Orlando. I don't know. I don't know what's up with this. You got to bring it back to Hawaii. And, hey, no offense to Orlando. It's got its charms. But, I mean, come on, Hawaii. Everyone wants to go to Hawaii.
Yeah, sure. What they need to do is have 2 Pro Bowls, one for the guys in their 20s who want to go to Hawaii, and then one for the guys, the players in their 30s who have kids who are like 5 or 6 years old now. Let them be the Orlando Pro Bowl. I mean, no, this is all garbage anyway. I mean, they can't even fight. You and me almost made the Pro Bowl AFC team at quarterback this year. So it's, you know, let there be 2 Pro Bowls, and that'll double the ratings, right? Is that how that works?
I'd play in that game because you're not allowed to blitz.
Yeah, I would you know what? I would play in that game too under that that condition.
I'll ask you real quick. Now that it's McDermott, does that make it more likely that they bring back Gilmore? I mean, they're going to have to pay a premium to bring back Gilmore regardless, but does it make more sense to bring back Gilmore under this defense than it did under the Rex Ryan defense, or is it the other way around?
Well, Rex Ryan's defense is a little more dependent on having a stopper at the perimeter cornerback spot. So it probably made a little more sense under Rex Ryan, but there are certain – look, that's a premium position. That's a hard position to find – high-level consistency at.
Yeah.
And I think you could make a case that Gilmore, though he hasn't always been this, I think when he's on his game, which is more often than not, he is one of those high-level consistency cornerbacks. So regardless of your scheme, he's worth money. And if you want to pay for it, I believe that's a position worth paying for, regardless of your system.
Yeah. And just flipping over to the other side of the ball real quick, as I once again make us talk about the Bills for way too long. Rick Dennison will be the offensive coordinator. He is, of course, a from that Kubiak line, that Shanahan line of coaches here. Dennison has connections with Tyrod Taylor from the past. He was in Baltimore when Tyrod was a backup. They also, the Broncos apparently tried to get Tyrod Taylor two off seasons ago, to back up Peyton Manning when Dennison was in Denver. I mean, it seems, it seems on paper that they might want to bring Tyrod Taylor back now. There has to be some sort of smoothing out with the front office people if they're going to do that. But, you know, I don't know if Tyrod is necessarily going to be a guy who's going to demand a lot of money on the open market.
The one part that would make me hesitant on all of this is that Buffalo, the last two seasons, had the best running game in the NFL. It was one of the best designed, certainly, and it was the most productive running game. And it was a gap scheme running game. So pull blockers, they would do read option concepts off of it. It's a different type of ground game under Rick Dennison, I'm assuming. If he does the Kubiak stuff, and maybe he won't, but if he does the Kubiak stuff, then that's an outside zone rushing attack. Very different. It's about finding one cut and hitting it downfield, and that's not LeSean McCoy's style of game. The nice thing with gap scheme is it allows for him to dance a little bit. It puts him within structure to dance. He still has a specific hole to hit, but he can kind of find different ways to get to that hole. There's some room for him to work there. So I don't know if a zone style ground attack fits this team, and they don't need to make a change there. Their running game was, again, the best in the league. It's not the problem. So you wonder what that's going to look like now.
Yeah, I mean, if you weren't going to make the change to that kind of system, though, why would you bring in Dennison to be your offensive coordinator? It's not like it's a head coach who's, you know, we talk about Lynn keeping Wisenhunt in place and you keep your system in place, but I mean, when you hire an offensive coordinator, you figure you're gonna play his system. You're not gonna bring him in and say run the old system.
No, you're not. And so, So it probably is safe to assume that Dennison. Now, Dennison hasn't been the head honcho of an offense for a while. Kubiak was the head honcho of the offense on that old staff that Dennison was on. So maybe he has other ideas, or there's more to his approach than we realize. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if you hire Rick Dennison, and then that's probably what you're signing up for. I think that would be a mistake. And I'm not saying Dennison can't coach. I just don't think that kind of approach. I mean, John Miller is not the most athletic of right guards. Jordan Mills is not the most athletic of right tackles. Richie Incognito's a much better fist fighter than he would be a smooth, cohesive technician, which is what the zone game would call for. Eric Wood would fit it, but the rest of their line, Cordy Glenn's not a nimble left tackle. He's a bigger-bodied guy. They're built for a gap scheme downhill type of attack.
It just, you know, it seems like you're sort of setting yourself up for a rebuild, and rebuild is something the Bills have, you know, they've been telling everyone, we're a playoff team, we have a great roster, we're ready for the playoffs the last couple of years, and they just let a guy go for not getting him to the playoffs. It was a curious hire to me, I guess I'll say. But if they did run that, you know, that Kubiak system, it would seem that Taylor fits fairly well in that. You're going to run some of those outside stretch runs and run the play action and the bootlegs off of that sort of half field read type of stuff. It seems like Taylor would fit all right in that.
Yeah, he would. That would be a way to help him. But keep in mind, those bootlegs are a little bit like the McDermott blitzes, is that they're anymore, they've become more of just a dimension to their offense. You know, they didn't run that very much with Trevor Siemian last year in Denver. Siemian was asked to drop back and play more from the pocket, and they felt the game demanded that. You have to have a pocket quarterback in the NFL, whether you're a bootleg team or not. At some point in every game, a critical point, third down, your quarterback has to drop back and throw from the pocket. And Tyrod Taylor, he's not the guy for that. So it's the system, yeah, that'll minimize his deficiencies, having that bootleg play-action game, but that's not going to sustain him. Those are snacks. They need an entree.
Yeah, yep. Well, let's. Oh, this does transition then, because we just talked about Denver and Kubiak, and Kubiak's replacement out in Denver will be Vance Joseph. I'm sorry, I'm so excited about these transitions. I usually don't write the show this way.
Yeah, you need Vance... to be a little cooler about them. You need to kind of we actually don't transition when we announce the transitions, you know. And now it's
some might say, but I can't contain my giddiness right now. Vance Joseph gets hired in Denver, and we talked a little bit about Kyle Shanahan, the fact they passed on him, but we didn't really talk about Vance Joseph himself getting the Broncos job, and he's a guy who had a very good reputation as a teacher. I think this is a head-scratcher for people, since the Dolphins secondary, which, you know, he's a secondary guy, and he was the Dolphins OC last year, or excuse me, defensive coordinator last year. You know, they weren't a particularly strong group statistically down in Miami.
I think what's revealing is who the Dolphins tapped as their defensive coordinator after Joseph left. They promoted Matt Burke, their linebackers coach. And it was under, he was there as the built-in replacement for Joseph anyway. They wanted to go in-house. That's the next guy up. They stayed in-house for it. What they're telling you is Adam Gase understood Joseph was not going to be around for long. And so Joseph has been a hot head coaching candidate within NFL circles. He's been a hot candidate for several years now. That's how Adam Gase knew that he needed to basically find two defensive coordinators, one for his first year or two in Miami, and then one for whoever comes after that. And so Joseph, yeah, they didn't have a great year in Miami, but Joseph was already a hot candidate before that. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, there's not a lot of jobs here. So head coaching jobs, there's plenty of guys that are worth hiring that teams want to hire, but you can't hire them. It's not, there's only five or six available spots a year. So the music stopped and Joseph didn't have a chair last season, but he's part of the musical chairs on the plus side now. And I think teams like how he teaches the game. I think it helps that he's a secondary coach. This stuff goes in waves. Back in the 90s, late 90s, a lot of linebacker coaches became defensive coordinators. It was more of a running offense than the NFL. Everybody was first and second down running games. Well, now you see more and more secondary coaches that become the coordinators because offenses throw the ball. It's a 60%, 70% passing league now. And Joseph's been one of the higher regarded secondary coaches in the league for a few seasons.
Yeah. Yeah. And for Denver fans who are disappointed that Kyle Shanahan was not the pick there, they, you know, look, they got a real good hire at offensive coordinator. They have Mike McCoy coming in there, who I think you and I were both really high on and felt shouldn't have lost his job in San Diego. But McCoy's a pretty nice, I don't want to call him a consolation prize, but I think maybe some Denver fans will view him that way, especially in light of the fact that they have some question marks at quarterback.
Yep, I like McCoy. And they also have Bill Musgrave, who I thought we talked about a lot about him this past season. He had a phenomenal year in Oakland, and they wanted to promote Todd Downing, a younger guy, and I'm sure it was about trying to keep Downing in place and on that team rather than getting rid of Musgrave. So they get a good quarterbacks coach, and Musgrave now has coached in Oakland, where he did very well. He coached a running team with Adrian Peterson and the Vikings in the early 2010s era, about 2012 in those seasons. And then he was in Philadelphia for a year under Chip Kelly. And we saw some of those principles, the Chip Kelly things, incorporated into what Musgrave did with the Raiders. So there's a very diverse recent background that Musgrave brings to the table. You mix that with Mike McCoy, who already has a nice shotgun system, a passing game. We talked about the crossing routes that San Diego's so good at. He's very good with three receiver concepts. that's a lot of football creativity on the table right there. You're bound to bump into something that's going to work for either Simeon or Paxton Lynch, whoever it is. My guess it'll be Simeon this year.
Yep. All right. So interesting hires in Denver. We'll say that. And we will move down to Jacksonville. This is the fifth job that was filled. We're not going to talk 49ers. We talked some 49ers on the Monday show if you want to check that out. But yeah, Doug Marrone keeps the job in Jacksonville, and he also keeps Nathaniel Hackett in town to be his offensive coordinator, which is very exciting to Syracuse alums like me. They're getting the whole band back together. But I think if you're a Jaguars fan right now, you are saying our quarterback just completely fell apart this year. And you sort of kept the same staff in place on the offensive side of the ball. How worried should Blake Bortles fans be about this?
Well, look, Blake Bortles is responsible for how he plays. And it's not the coaching that made Blake Bortles a bad thrower this season. And that's what he was. He threw the ball poorly. He wound up and would release the ball, and it would come out awful. And he was mechanics went to hell in a handbasket. You didn't know what you were getting from him from pass to pass. That's not a Blake. That's not a coordinator issue. What do you? You can't coach with that. I mean, what do you do? You can call more handoffs, and then you get criticized for being uncreative because all you do is hand the ball off. So they bring back Hackett after Bortles had a bad season. But those are two, they're not separate, but they're two, they're separate and they're not separate. You know, you have to play with Bortles. He's your guy. You got to work around his strengths and weaknesses, but you're not the one causing those weaknesses to be as glaring as they were. That's on Bortles. And Blake Bortles would tell you that. He knows that. And I'm sure he takes ownership of that. So it's a matter of what do you get out of Bortles. And that's really where the discussion is. Hackett was an interesting coordinator. He had the job from Greg Olsen down the stretch this season. Mm-hmm. He believes in bunches a lot. Why three receivers grouped together? He was very good with that. Also believes in putting all of his receivers to one side of the field and leaving a tight end on the other side of the field. That's something we see more and more teams doing. So he's a newer age thinker in terms of formations and then consequently the route concepts that come out of the formations. So I think he's fine to have as an offensive coordinator. It's a matter of figuring out how to help that quarterback be a better fundamental execution guy.
All right. So that's what's going down in Jacksonville. We are on the Sunday show. We're going to talk a little more about some of the other things going on around the league, including Greg Minuski gets the defense coordinator job in Washington, and Jim Tomsula is there. Good to see Jim Tomsula back. But Washington stays in-house for their new D.C., and Chuck Pagano, at least for now, staying on, and we'll talk about him. But we have a mailbag to open. Before we get into the mailbag, I wanted to just mention very quickly, if you are in Houston for the Super Bowl, either you live there or maybe you're traveling there, Peter King's podcast, they're doing a live show. It is going to be very exciting. It is on Thursday, February 2nd. You can check our site for ticket details. It's $100, but you get free food and free beer with that $100. Right now, Chris Berman is booked. Two more guests are going to be on the way, but it should be very exciting. If you're down there, I would certainly recommend you go. Check out the MMQB.com for details, or just check out, it's all over the place on social. Just Google it. Just Google the thing. That's all anyone does anyway. But let's go on to the mailbag.
The 10 Things Mailbag starts now.
If you want to write into the mailbag, we love getting your questions, and we're going to have a whole off season of questions to take here. You can get us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit, or G_Grambling_SI. We're both on Facebook. Facebook's great because you can write as long as you want. There's no character limit like they have on the old Twitter. Or you can write into talkback@themmqb.com. But let's rip this thing open. We're going to start with Twitter. This is Simon Wojnarowski, who, as he points out, actually started the Huge in Australia hashtag for us a couple of weeks ago, and it's true. It's an unnecessary hashtag because everyone knows it is true. But Simon asks, which quarterback in the Super Bowl will face the most pressure? And I'm going to boil this down, Andy, because I actually want to know, we've talked about when Tom Brady's been beaten in the past, it's been because he's been pressured. And Denver could pressure him while they drop some of those guys back. So you sort of get the best of both worlds when they're going up against Brady. The Falcons, you know, like pretty much every other team in the league, don't really have the capacity to do that. So basically, how are the Falcons going to generate pressure on Tom Brady?
They're going to have to hope that their guys win, that Vic Beasley wins, that Grady Jarrett wins, and that they get penetration. It'll have to be quick penetration. Now, what's interesting is Atlanta's really not set up for quick penetration. When they're at their best, it is with stunts and twists and gap exchange things, which take time. And that worked well against Green Bay, a team that has, with Rodgers' style of play, the ball's not always going to be out on time. With Brady, that's not the case. So I don't think pressure is going to be a big factor on either side here, because I don't think you're going to get to Matt Ryan. The Patriots really don't have an explosive pass rush, and it's we know how hard it is to get to Tom Brady. So I don't think that's where the game will be won and lost.
Yeah. So bet the over is what I'm going to tell people. It's not even to 60.
And what does that mean? What's the over-under?
It was like 57.
For
that's
point?
Not that much. It's really high.
Yeah, okay. I thought there was an over-under for sacks on that. I thought that's.
Oh, on sacks? No. Well, I'm sure there is, but I don't know what it is. I'm just saying bet the over on points here, because no one's going to stop these quarterbacks.
Yeah, no, I got you. The one thing to keep in mind, though, both of these are bend but not break defenses, and both of these are very efficient offenses with veteran QBs. And sometimes what you get with that are longer scoring drives, because the veteran QBs, bend but don't break. Okay, we know what that means. We know where the voids are in that. We'll take the 6 and 7 yard completions and march down the field gradually. That's making the smart play. And Brady and Ryan, that's kind of how they play, especially Brady. So when you get that, the drives are longer and scores can be inherently lowered, the number, because you're just not getting as many possessions. So both teams might score 6 times that they touch the ball, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be a 45 to 41 type game, or they might score on 60% of their drives. Let's put it that way. But if they're only driving the ball 7 or 8 times in the game, or 9 times or something like that, you know, I might bet the under on this one, actually.
All right. So bet the under or bet the over. Really, my
salary,
advice to people is
salary, year salary for another year here.
Yes. That third year salary. I'm just going to keep
I'll
on storing it away. I'll bet the over. We'll go double or nothing on the 2 years salary that you owe me.
Okay.
My advice to people is don't bet on the Super Bowl. Find something else to bet on. You're going to watch the Super Bowl anyway, so who cares?
If you're listening to this podcast, don't bet, because it means you care about football. If you don't care about football, I would bet all kinds of stuff, because if you're going to watch it, what else you have to do? But our listeners should not be betting on the Super Bowl. They should just appreciate it for what it is.
Exactly. Next question is coming from Zachary Trapp via TalkBack. Is there a good reason the Colts insist on running a vertical power run type offense? Seems like all the 5 and 7 step dropbacks and slow developing routes only further bring out the personnel issues they have on the offensive line.
That's been a point that a lot of people have made. I think it's a good one. And my answer to that is I would almost guarantee you at this point, Andrew Luck prefers that style of drop back game. And when you have a QB like Luck, you give him a voice in the meeting rooms. You want to play to what he wants to play to. And even though his offensive line, it's not a great line, or it's a young developing offensive line, that's not ideal for that. And they put a lot of pressure on him, but I think Luck is comfortable with that, because that's how Luck likes to play. He wants to attack the field north and south.
I feel like they need to find their Todd Haley. Like, Todd Haley came in and sort of changed the way Ben Roethlisberger played and made sure the ball was getting out of his hand a little bit quicker. I feel like they need that for Andrew Luck. Maybe not immediately, but sometime in the next couple years.
That's an interesting point, and that's a point certainly worth thinking more about. And if they want to be that, I think they can be that with Rob Trudzinski. What he does so well is multi-tight end sets. And Indianapolis last year, we didn't talk about this much, but they ran multi-tight end sets, 2 tight ends mainly. They played 2 tight ends more than any team in the NFL. So if they're going to play that way, that's naturally conducive to a deeper drop-back game, but you got to have the right personnel for it. And Maybe Doyle and Dwayne Allen are the guys. I don't know. I'll be interested to see. It's only the second year under Chudzinski. He didn't really run that show, if I recall, until this past season. So we'll see how they look now that they get another year together here.
Yeah, well, he came in. I mean, he came in when Pep Hamilton got let go, which was midway through 2015. So he's really only had a season and a half there. And really, one season.
Correct, because you can't install everything brand new, although Jim Bob Cooter did in Detroit a little bit with Matthew Stafford, and it worked out. But it'll be interesting to see.
If I remember correctly, Luck was also hurt when Chudzinski took over, so he had Hasselbeck instead of Luck there.
Yeah, so let's call it 1 year then. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Next one is coming from Andrew from Delaware via TalkBack. While watching Atlanta Green Bay, I noticed that Kyle Shanahan was regularly splitting out fullback Patrick DeMarco, using him out wide. What's the purpose? My initial thoughts were either create a mismatch elsewhere on offense or provide downfield blocking. But knowing Kyle Shanahan, those reasons could easily be incorrect. So Andy, take it away.
Yes, this is a great question. I love this one. The first part of his guess at the purpose, that's kind of correct. It is create matchups elsewhere. What happens is when you put a fullback out wide, and it's true with a tight end too, but it's especially true with a fullback, the defense reveals if it's man or zone coverage by who they put across from that fullback. If you see a cornerback across from the fullback, you know no defense is ever going to have a corner cover a fullback man-to-man. Why would you draw that up? That's a waste of a corner. So that corner, if he's across from the fullback, that means that corner's in zone coverage, and that fullback's out wide in the corner zone. So now you know the coverage. And if that's the case, then the other guys inside of him, your Julio Jones, your Mohamed Sanu, they know they're facing zone defense, and the inside defenders in zone are usually your linebackers and your safeties. So there's your mismatch that you get. Now, if it's a linebacker that follows the fullback out wide, and especially in their case, a slow linebacker, they're a big base type of linebacker, then you know it's man-to-man because that's who you would put on your fullback. So teams like to do that because of the coverage indicator. And in Atlanta's case, a lot of times what they'll probably have is a play design where if they see zone before the snap, Matt Ryan knows I'm working the left side of the field. And if he sees it's man-to-man before the snap, he knows I'm working the right side of the field. And the routes are drawn up to beat zone on the left or man-to-man on the right, and that's how they play. It's one of the advantages you see. More teams are going to be doing this. It's just too good of information you get out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, Patriots shoot all the time with James Devlin. This is a very fullback. This is a very fullbacky Super Bowl. I'm excited about
that. It is. And that's not a coincidence, by the way, that these are two teams that play fullbacks on about 30% of the snaps, and on about half of those 30% of the snaps, they might be inclined to split that fullback out wide. It's simple but cutting edge stuff that really helps a quarterback, and with a veteran smart star QB, that's extremely valuable.
Yep. By the way, there's a good one down there in Mobile, Freddie Stevenson, the Florida State guy, is a really good fullback. I think he would have been like a second or third round pick back in the day. But yeah, I think he's going to go like mid rounds because fullbacks are back in vogue here. Going to be very exciting. Next question comes via Facebook. This is Gregory Urquiaga. I'm sorry, Gregory. I just you're just Gregory. Gregory from Facebook. With the Niners hiring Shanahan, or you know, they're going to hire Shanahan, what type of quarterback will he be looking to get? Is it going to be accurate pocket guy, or will he put more of an emphasis on mobility? Shanahan, of course, he had a good year with RG3 back in the day in Washington. So, and also, would they chase a guy like an AJ McCarron or someone like that?
You might want something a little more mobile than McCarron. I haven't seen a lot of McCarron, but you might want something a little more mobile than him. And by the way, McCarron, I heard, was stopping by the Senior Bowl today. I spent time with...
Oh, yeah?
Ken Zampezi, the offensive coordinator of the Bengals, we drove around for a bit, and he said McCarron was on his way. So we'll see if McCarron drops into town. But
well, he's from the area.
That's what Zampezi said. Look, remember what Kyle Shanahan did with Matt Ryan. Matt Ryan was not a mobile QB. Now, he had improved on that under Dirk Cutter towards the end of Cutter's tenure in Atlanta as the offensive coordinator, but he really wasn't a fully mobile QB yet. under Shanahan, he's become a mobile QB within the context of their scheme there in Atlanta. He's very functional as a mobile pocket, as a moving pocket passer, let's call it that. So I think Shanahan's thinking would be that you can teach mobility more than you can teach pocket passing, which might seem totally backwards because, you know, you got to be able to run. And if you can't run, how can you be mobile? But it's not about that as much. It's harder to teach a guy to be a good passer than it is to teach a guy to play on the move.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think you find the pocket passing QB. Yeah.
Yeah. Next one. This is actually less question and more note, but I thought it was a neat note. This is a Chip from Georgia via Talkback. Falcons making it to the Super Bowl means that every NFC South team, they are the first division to have all four teams go to the Super Bowl since realignment in 2002 when the Texans were at it. I thought that was a neat note. Everyone in the NFC West but the Rams have made it, by the way. The Rams are holding them back. But, Andy, does this mean anything to you? Because we've kind of, you know, they were, NFC South was a laughingstock a couple years ago.
Yeah, no, it's a neat factoid. It's a bar fact kind of thing. Maybe I'll say it tonight when I go out here to Beats in Mobile across from the hotel that everyone stays, but that's it.
You'll be the hit of the Mobile nightlife with that fact.
Yeah. That'll, well, keep in mind, the AFC East has the Patriots to deal with, so it's not necessarily always the strength of the division. It could just be the strength of who's at the top of the division.
It's neat, though. They've all had quarterbacks in that division. I guess that would be the answer. They've all had good quarterbacks who have been with their teams for a while. So,
yeah,
yeah.
Talking about the NFC South. Yeah.
NFC South, not the AFC East. Yeah, they've had other issues at quarterback. This last one here is coming from Mark from Thunder Bay via Talkback, wondering whether Andy, who is at the Senior Bowl, has gained any insight as to how the Browns view their quarterback situation. Do you think there could be an outlier QB play such as AJ McCarron, someone who Hugh Jackson has a relationship with?
You know, I hate to disappoint Mark, but actually the teams that are coaching, they're the teams that it's hardest to meet with their coaches because they actually have stuff to do all day long. They have player meetings and they don't really game plan, but they've got stuff to go over with the guys. So I haven't talked to anybody from the Browns and the Bears guys. I'm going to see them at the end of the week when everything's kind of settled. So I have no idea how the Browns feel about their quarterback situation or where their thinking is right now.
Well, we'll check in maybe next week then. See how that's going. Yeah, Browns fans are going to be bummed. I know they have the first two picks, and Mitch Trubisky is a Cleveland guy who's a proud Cleveland guy. He loves talking Cleveland, but it you know, I work with Emily Kaplan on the college column, which is our draft column, and it sounds like it's Myles Garrett is going to be the number one overall pick, the edge guy from Texas A&M. So they might take a quarterback with that 12 pick. Maybe Trubisky will still be there, but yeah, they have some options. But they got to do something. They do need a new answer at quarterback here.
Yeah, well, they also badly need an answer at pass rusher too. So Myles Garrett would conceptually that position, that would not be the worst thing either.
Yep. Well, that's going to do it for this show, Andy. We will do the Sunday show. We'll find some things to talk about since obviously there are no games besides the Pro Bowl. Maybe we'll just break down the Pro Bowl for an hour and a half. Or maybe just break down, like, our favorite Pro Bowls ever, 2009.
He doesn't mean it, folks. He doesn't mean it. Join us on Sunday. We'll come up with something of substance. Send us mailbag stuff. Send us ideas. We promise you. I promise you. I'm not going to speak about the Pro Bowl. So if you talk about it, you know, I'll just give you dead air because that's the best that I could offer for that game.
No, look, I've jotted down for the Sunday show. We're going to talk some Chuck Pagano. We're going to talk some Greg Minuski, the new defensive coordinator in Washington. We can talk some Roethlisberger maybe, and I don't think he's going to retire, but he's going to retire eventually. Maybe the Steelers need to start thinking about their next quarterback. So we'll have some stuff to talk about.
I think this is where we make the desperate plea for more mailbag questions right here.
It'll be a good show. And we'll also talk some Super Bowl, of course. But that's going to do it for this show right now. Thank you so much to our producer, Matt Havia, for putting up with us with the whole Mobile connection here. I think it's worked out pretty much as well as it could have. And Sean Cherry helped out with that, too. Of course, thank you to Chris Basil, who edits all this stuff and makes us sound half human, and Jeff Irwin, our researcher, who makes us sound like we actually know what we're talking about. And thank you, most of all, to listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. We really do appreciate it, and honestly, keep on sending the mailbag questions. We're gonna need them once the offseason starts. I mean, we'll have free agency in the draft, but you know, there will be holes to fill in, and we want to know what you guys are curious about. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts. That includes the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys first thing Monday morning.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.